Today is November 21st, 1980. This is Douglas Haller, and I'm interviewing Professor Leslie Lyle Hannawalt at his home in the Art Center Apartments, which are located on the edge of the Wayne State University campus in Detroit. Professor Hannawalt is retired since 1968 from a long and distinguished career at the university, where he held, amongst many positions, the position of university historian. And I would like to ask him some questions today concerning his role as director of the History of Wayne Project. Professor Hannawalt, what was the History of Wayne Project?
Well, this was a proposal to get the first history of Wayne State University written and published by somebody by the time of the anniversary year, which of course would be 1968. And this was assigned to me by President Hillbury at my suggestion. And so it took me from 1956 to 1968 to do this job, although actually the book was in print in 1967, so in a way you could say it took only 9 years.
1956, that was the same year that Wayne University became Wayne State University, is that correct?
Yes.
Tell me, in addition to being a scholarly undertaking, did the History of Wayne Project have any, would you say, public relations value to it as well, being that this was the centennial year of the university?
Oh, yes. The president and other important people around the campus felt that this was an important item, would be an important item in the centennial when it came around 10 years from now. And 10 years from then. And of course it was a logical thing. Moreover, it's become somewhat traditional. A great many colleges and some businesses do get out historical accounts of themselves on their centennials. Sometimes it's sesquicentennial. But anyway, that was regarded as a part of, as an important item in the coming centennial year.
During the course of the project and after the publication of the book itself, did you yourself engage in any public relations related activities connected with the project in the book? For example, television or radio or things of that nature?
Oh, yes, I was engaged in more than I wanted to be, of radio interviews and luncheon speeches and a lot of things that would logically follow. Some of them were rather fun, but of course the tension was off then. I didn't have to worry about getting the job done anymore.
Tell me, what was the budget and the staff provided for this particular project?
Well, I was, of course, I received my regular salary, a professor's salary, and I had a full-time secretary assistant throughout this project, with one lapse when nobody could be found who was qualified. Without the help of this second person, I could never have been done, because this person had to be able to, well, a couple of them had MA degrees in history, and this person had to be a good typist, and that means be able to hear dictation and write it down accurately. She had to be ready to get acquainted closely with the library system so that she could go and hunt up books for me. I always had a shelf of books there changing in my office. But the time to go and find these plagued books would have been ruinous if I'd had to do it myself. And so some of these gals got so good at it that they could glance through and put in markers where they thought I would want to make some notes. And often I could just put in a marker and tell them what to jot down, how much to take down, how much to copy down, and what headings to put on it. And I didn't have to dictate it. They didn't have to listen to it. They just copied. We had no Xerox, of course. Copying all had to be done by hand.
Through carbon? With the use of carbon?
Use what?
Carbon paper.
Carbon paper wasn't much help, except for one thing. If I was pretty sure that a note, let's say about football in 1920 and football in 1940, if I was pretty sure that a note about that would be useful in both those places in the book, I would use a carbon. File 1 under 1920, file 1 under 1940, and therefore mark one of them duplicate, and thus save copying more than once.
The clerical task must have been an enormous one.
It was.
Did you devise any type of note-taking system to assist you in this task?
Yes, I took over a system that had been used by some of the men in history, and this meant getting every note into this on the same size of paper, which was a half sheet of typing paper, and every note with the items in the same order, in the same place, the date of the occurrence and the source and the main topic and subtopic, always in the same place on the hook, so that the notes could be sorted later according to date or subject or source. You have to have a system about this, because I ended with, as I guess I said, I ended with about 30,000 of these notes. And 30,000 notes is a lot of paper. They now fill, these notes now fill 5 or 6 drawers in a 5x9 drawer, 5x9 dimension. And it's quite a question how we're going to store them permanently.
With all those notes, they had to come from source material, of course, and in the course of the History of Wayne Project, you gathered a great volume of the university's archives. Would you tell us something about that process?
Well, Wayne had no formally organized archives when I began. The historians of many colleges and universities had a great advantage over me that way. I was doing the first history, and I was getting together the first archives. Now, you don't find that very many places. Ordinarily, you like University of Chicago, where I went, and others, you'll find that they've not only got all this together, but there's already been one history written. And that one history is a big help. You can avoid things and pick out things. So I started in gathering the raw materials. Some things, of course, I knew from memory, having been here a good many years, but that's only a minor aid. It helps you to verify things and to get things in their order, but that's only minor memory. I started in collecting, first of all, archival materials that were on paper. That means they may have been saved in the president's files or some other file on the campus, but most of the paper didn't come from those systematic sources, or at least a great part did not. I gathered a lot from letters, files of letters, and also I corresponded a great deal. I suppose my correspondence file would show, which has been saved, would show at least half of the letters are those that I wrote out to people asking them questions. These are people who had been here before as students or as faculty people or as the relatives of faculty people or as friends of the president or somebody. And so the correspondence was terrific. I used to use a dictaphone, one of these things with cylinders, and it was nothing at all for me to have an accumulation of 8 or 10 cylinders all the time, ready for the stenographer to go ahead with. And on each cylinder, I'd got 8 or 10 letters. I'd have to write. I wrote everywhere. I would have to write and say, "Do you know where such and such is living?" Now, this is a person who had been on the faculty and was now probably 80 years old. Do you know where he is? So I got a reply back. And then I have to write the letter to the person. There were cases when I would write a letter with several copies and send them to a half dozen people. And I get replies back, and all these have to be kept in order. And from the letters, you have to take your extracts into your notes and put them in order so that the paperwork was terrific. Some of the hardest of this was from tapes, the stuff on tapes. What are you going to do with materials on a tape? You can't copy it from the tape onto a typewriter, and you can't turn the tape over to a stenographer and say, "Type it all out." I did that once or twice, but not anymore. That just took too much time.
It's very time consuming.
So I had to devise ways of marking spaces on the tapes and giving the headings for it so that the stenographer could use the headings and listen to just that much of the tape, type it off, and have me another note. All the sources of, and of course we did not a great deal in books, historical sources. Right on the first page of my book, I state the square area of the city of Detroit. I think it's 140 square miles. Well, I wanted to put that in for a particular reason right on the first page. Well, where do you find such information? So I sent my girl to hunting, and she found undoubtedly the best source. I found there was a yearbook that is gotten out by the city, and so we took it down from there, 140. Well, sometime later, there appeared a book for a man in history, a small history of Detroit, and it said 46 square miles. And I said, oh, well, what are we going to do now? So we went and checked our sources. Sure enough, 150 appeared to be correct. Finally, one day on the campus, I met this man and said, where did you get the figure 146 square miles? Oh, he said, I don't know. I don't know where I got it. I suppose I got it from this or this or this. So there's no help.
Yeah.
Finally, I made a phone call to the Detroit Surveyor's Office and asked them for the official figure. And I got it. It was 150.
So you were right.
We were right.
Yes.
But think of the time we wasted checking up on the accuracy of something. It's a good example of what you have to do very often.
In the course of gathering these archives, the university archives were officially created. I believe it was in 1958. What was the role then, once they were created, of the archives in the History of Wayne Project?
Well, the role of the archives was simply to furnish me all the information I wanted. And at that time, of course, we got an official archivist, Philip Mason. We couldn't have got a better one anywhere. And he, of course, took over most of his hunting. And he would dig things out for me, or help the girl to dig things out. So this was a big aid. Phil and I did a good deal of hunting around the campus for where we thought there might be papers hidden and lost track of. We often wore coveralls down here because attics are dusty and dirty, and gloves. There were some things in steel files, but we got up into the third floor attic of what used to be called a castle on Warren Avenue, and where the president and vice president had their offices on lower floors, of course. And we got up into that attic and pulled the parcels of paper around and brought a lot of them down and lugged them over to the office. And we went down to the same corner, to the corner of 2nd Avenue and Warren, to the third floor, and rattled around, and we brought some valuable stuff from there. We went clean through the McKenzie home, which has been in the papers much lately, and never found a thing that was a help there. But so we did a lot of that digging around in the odd places.
And then the acquisition of a trained archivist was a great help to you in acquiring the information that you needed to write the history.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. He was a great help. And I often ask his advice about this or that, no telling what, just because he'd had so much experience at everything, though very young. And so it was a big help.
In around 1948, the first oral history interviews were conducted at Columbia University by Alan Nevins. You began to use oral history in 1956 with the History of Wayne Project. Would you tell us something about your experiences with oral history at that time?
Well, you mean about getting stuff down in oral form? Well, let me tell you one episode. The first interview that I rigged up. Oh, I was much impressed with this, and of course I had one of these great big machines as big as two suitcases fastened together, and a very fine microphone and all, and I reserved a nice wood-paneled room over in Old Main in the basement part, which became later Home Economics room. Quiet afternoon, a wonderful time. And I've got together three men, not easy to get together, who were in on the foundation of the School of the College of Pharmacy, which had its beginnings actually down in Cass High School. And these three men were all familiar with that. They'd been in it. And so we started in, and we're talking along there in mid-afternoon, and had quite a long interview, and I was very happy about it. So I was anxious to see how this sounded. And I went home that evening and settled down with my pipe and to listen to this tape, and it was wonderful. But all of a sudden, in the midst of all this quiet, there came out the loud, most raucous, raw kind of music. "You don't owe me a thing but love, baby." It turned out, and this was sung by somebody named Ray, I was told.
Johnny Ray.
Somebody I wouldn't listen to voluntarily, certainly. I took the outfit. Well, first of all, I decided I must try to get that interview out of there. There was no way to get those three men back together again. They were elderly and they lived on a distance. And so I spent most of that night and a good many other hours with the headphones clamped on and my typewriter before me, trying to listen to our gentle voices back of this radio music. It was an awful ordeal, and I was able to dig out most of the essentials because I could remember a phrase here and there if I could hear something. When I took the machine up to the supply department, they said, "Oh, well, we know what happened, all right. We've had it happen before." I wanted to ask them why the hell they didn't prevent it, but apparently it didn't occur all the time. The trouble was that the microphone cord, by some kind of radio quirk, had become like an antenna. And so Ray was coming in on my antenna, on my microphone cord, just as plain as could be.
He was broadcasting at the same time, and it came right over your microphone.
That's right. His program started at 3:30 in the afternoon, and that's when my troubles started.
Amazing.
Well, this is just one of the, this is one of those big old machines. Now, a little later, when I had a somewhat smaller machine, maybe as heavy as a large portable typewriter, I went downtown to interview a former member of the Board of Education. And I got all hooked up in his office. He's a lawyer, and not very talkative, and anyhow, I got all set, sitting there with the machine running, and started asking him questions, and I got a smell. And I knew right away what it was burning insulation. So I grabbed the button out of the wall. There was a little wisp of smoke out of the machine. And I trusted that the machine wasn't ruined. And I went ahead with the interview. Well, luckily, it turned out that the interview didn't amount to anything, so I hadn't missed anything. But when I got this up to the technicians again, they said, oh, yes, you were in the Hammond Building. And that Hammond Building is the last of the buildings downtown that are on direct current. All others are on alternating. Nobody had told me about direct current.
And so the interview was ruined, in effect. It didn't come through at all.
Yes, but I didn't care because he didn't say anything worth listening to anyhow. He didn't know anything much.
Tell me, how did you make the selections for people to be interviewed? Did you have a particular criterion for selecting people to be interviewed orally?
No, except for what I thought they would know. Here's a person who was had been librarian for a number of years, and I knew where she had come from. Well, I was pretty sure that I could get some information I did not have about how people of her generation got their jobs down here. She was incompetent, and I knew that. So I lugged my big machine over snow drifts and ice drifts and stuff, got to her apartment, and had a lot of useless talk. And incidentally, she was interested in bridge. Wanted to know if I played bridge, and she was interested right away. And did I use such and such a convention? Yes. Well, maybe I'd like to play on their team. And so I began backing off. I didn't want to play anywhere near her. Anyhow, I did learn through what a political pull a lot of people in the Board of Education system got their jobs in Detroit. It was a change off between Frank Cody, who was superintendent here, and between the man, Harris, maybe his name was, a superintendent of schools in Lansing, state superintendent. And they did favors for each other, and probably to the benefit of all, for all I know. But anyway, it didn't smell right.
Despite some of these inconveniences of the early technology in tape recording equipment, did you feel that your work with oral history was largely successful insofar as it contributed to the writing of the history of Wayne?
Oh, I think so. I think so. I don't think that without the oral recording to begin with, I don't think I could have got the job done. There's just too much of it. I've already mentioned it's accumulation of cylinders, every cylinder with 10 items on it. This is a lot of writing. And you can't go through all the steps of this without the aid of the technology.
What has become of the tapes that you made? Are they still on file in the university?
They were wide tapes.
Reel to reel?
What?
Were they reel to reel type tapes?
No, they were separate. They were separate, and you slipped them on under tension, and when the machine had recorded over to the end of it, why, you released it, took it off, put a label on it, and put it in the, well, it doesn't matter. I said cylinders. As a matter of fact, these were, they had changed from cylinders to broad tape, 5 inches wide, plastic. A very good recording. And there was a way to mark the end of letters. There was a marker on there and so on. And it worked quite well. You had to put a number down and something to keep yourself straight.
But you mentioned that due to the clerical difficulties, you didn't usually transcribe the tapes. Is that correct?
That's right. After a few times, I didn't transcribe an entire tape. I could type pretty fast, and I did all my writing on a typewriter. But and the girls could do it pretty fast, could type pretty fast. But the there's too much wasted effort.